we're going to work our way to the Book of the Zohar, the major work of the mystical writings in the medieval age. However, in order to understand what is the uniqueness of the Zohar, we need to understand the background that brought its inauguration. The Zohar is not a book. The Zohar is like an encyclopedia in a sense. It's a collection of many books. It's not one book, it's numerous things. And scholarship is debating whether one person worked it or whether a group of persons wrote it together. But before we are getting there, we need to ask a few questions. Where did it come from? What was the background that it grew upon? What is the mentality that enables it? And we need to see the mental origins and the historical origins. The beginning of Kabbalah is divided in three places. We call it Provence, Catalonia, and Castilla. Provence, that's in France, in the southern part, in the area close to Languedoc, to Toulouse, Marseille, the area which is called southern France. The Jews have been sitting in Provence since the ancient times, since the Roman period. Jews have been ancient residents in Provence. However, in the days of Charlemagne, or Charles the Great, Jews were given special rights. Charlemagne built the city of Narbonne. He made it his capital. He divided it. Narbonne, it's hard to hear, there is some noise, I'm sorry. I don't know what to do.
What year is Charlemagne?
He was living between 742 to 814. We can say that he was reigning and making things in the very end of the 8th century and in the beginning of the 9th century. The reason to recall this particular historical fact is that in the days of Charlemagne, the Jews were given rights that they didn't have before. He built a new city, Narbonne. Well, it was old city, but he made it his capital. And he divided it to three portions. One was for the cathedral and the church, one was for the viscount, or the viscount of the place, the prince, and one was called the new city, the area of the Jews. The Jews had relative autonomy in Narbonne. They were welcome to have their own intellectual centers, their own Batei Midrash, their own yeshivot. And because they enjoyed relative freedom, those things were working out. Narbonne was a big port city, and it was a big merchant city, and it had good connections with Italy on the one side, with Spain on the other side. So it was, as I said, in southern France. In Narbonne, in the area of Narbonne, which is in the province of Languedoc, next to Provence, all this area, it was a center of Jewish life. Jewish life was thriving there, with relative rights. As I said, it's always relative in the Christian world, but they had permission to have study places, to have relative autonomy, and to deal with whatever they want. The interesting thing was that it was around the family. It was like when you had a study house there, it wasn't like a public study house, it was a family study house. The family of Rabbi Abraham ben David, his father Rabbi Abraham ben Yitzchak, his son Rabbi Yitzchak Kalinaor, his grandson Asher ben David, there was a family there. And around this family, there were other students who came from various places. People came from Spain, people came from Italy. It was known to be important place of study, and because of the fact that the Jews had their rights, which they didn't have in other places, there was a continuity. There is historical testimony, on Jewish scholarship there from 9th century, 10th century, 11th century, 12th century. There are number of centuries, consecutive centers of study, which engendered new ways of thought. Now what they were doing, first of all, I mentioned that already, they were doing midrash. They were writing down midrashim, midrash like Bereshit Rabbati, midrash like Lekach Tov, we think so, midrash Konen. There are a number of midrashim, what we call late midrashim, that have been written and edited in this area of the end of the millennium, end of the first millennium, beginning of the second millennium, in this particular area. A person of great importance, Yehuda HaBarcelon, from Barcelona, was closely associated with these circles, and he wrote down the whole entire literature, or the whole entire world worldviews of the Southern France scholarship, in his book, which is called Perush LeSefer Yetzirah. We have a good historical perspective on what was going on in their mind, what they were interested in. In this time, at the turn of the millennium, at the end of the first millennium, beginning of the second millennium, where they start to write Midrashim, we are told about three or four different centers of knowledge. First of all, there are Baalei Halacha. Ravad Bala Sagot, Rabbi Yitzchak, Abraham Ben Yitzchak, Bala Eshkol. They are halakhic authorities for the area known as southern France and the borders of Spain, the Pyrenees. They are halakhic authorities. They are people who are highly valued within the halakhic world. They are the rabbinical halakhic authority of the area. There is no other. They are inaugurating writing of Midrashim. They are interested in Midrashim. They are inaugurating translation of philosophical writing. They are starting to develop a way of life which says something like, everyone has to study halakha, everyone has to study midrash. We choose, among those who study halakha and midrash, we choose certain number of people who would be initiated to some other kinds of knowledge. But what is feeding those circles is the Midrash and Halakha. In those very circles, as I said, they are ordering to translate philosophical books, and they also transmit and teach the mystical writing of the last century of the first millennia, or the first century of the second millennia. They have Sefer Yetzirah and they have Sefer Habakkuk. Those are anonymous writings. But within this anonymous writing, or written tradition of mystical teaching, they start something new, which hasn't been there before. They start to develop a notion of secrets, of heavenly secrets, which are revealed to the others. I mentioned the concept of Gilui Aliyah. It means that people are authorized to start to develop new insights, new ideas, new interpretations which haven't been heard before. When we ask what is the content of this new way of thinking, first of all we have to say, in this circle, in Provence, they did not allow to write it. It was oral law. Mysticism started as oral law. Second millennium Jewish mysticism started as an oral law. Just like halakha was for many centuries oral law, mysticism started as oral law in the first few centuries of the second millennium in Provence. What does it mean, oral law? They did not allow to write. They taught it. They memorized it. They wrote little hints about it. So in order to recover what were their teachings, we can't say, let's read the books of Abraham ben David. There is no such a thing as a Kabbalistic book of the Rabbi, of Rabbi Abraham ben David. What we do is, we have numerous quotations of his students. What did Abraham ben David, the Rabbi, Baal HaSagot, what did he say? The same goes for his father, Abraham ben Yitzchak Baal HaEshkol. We don't have a Kabbalistic book of Rabbi Abraham ben Yitzchak. What do we have? Quotations of teachings that he said. The first person that we have a whole Kabbalistic text from is Rabbi Yitzchak Sagina Hor, Yitzchak Biblein, and this particular text is known as Perush Sefer Yetzirah. He is offering an interpretation of Sefer Yetzirah, that by now you all know how Sefer Yetzirah looks. You know, it is a concise text. But what does it refer to? Where does it come from? What is it about? One may argue, and people argued about it. There was about one consensus, one idea that was within consensus. Sefer Yetzirah is telling us that the language is divine. That's what's very obvious. That language is divine. That the divine language is the understructure of being. Language is divine. Sefer Yetzirah is telling us, as you recall, that God Almighty created the world with 22 letters and 10 digits. Now those 22 letters and 10 digits are the inner structure of the whole entire being. The mystical idea is about how to decipher this inner language beyond the external being. They ask, what is the center of this internal divine language, beyond the language that we use for communicating? They ask, what is the center of this language? How should you address it? And they bring the following answer. It is the name of God, Hashem HaMeforash, the ineffable name, that is the very center of the holy language. First they say, the language is divine. Second they say, what's the focus of the holy language? The answer is, the ineffable name of God. A great deal of early mysticism is pure speculation on the meaning of the early, or on the meaning of the ineffable name of God. What is it consisted of? How should you write it? Are you allowed to talk it? Are you allowed to conjugate it? Are you allowed to punctuate it? Now there is a great deal of tension because the halakha prohibits us to say God's name. But God's name is the center of the mystical speculation. In a very complicated way, they ask, what are the letters? Is it possible that a letter is missing? Is it possible that a letter has been added? They are speculating on the names of God, on the way that it should be said, although it should not be said. There is a tension there in the midst of this mystical writing, and it's all around the name of God, which is the center of the mystical language. And they want to know, what can one say about it? They have to rely on previous traditions. We are told in Sifrut HaEchalot that God and His name are identical, that the infinite power of God is reflected in the ineffable name. Now, no one is supposed to say it, with the exception of Kohen Gadol, or with Kohanim who were saying Birkat Kohanim b'Mikdash. Nobody else was supposed to say it. So if they want to say, they're supposed to see themselves as priests, as high priests. That's the way they see themselves. The people who are the inaugurators of new Jewish mysticism in the second millennium are depicting themselves as meshartim b'kodesh, as serving in the Holy of Holies. Now, it's not the Holy of Holies on earth, because none is available. They see themselves as serving in the Holy of Holies in heaven, imagining in their mind the Holy of Holies in heaven. I want to read to you, how do they say? Rabbi Ezra, among the students of Rabbi Yitzchak Sagi Nahor, said, Amar Rabbeinu HaChassid, our pious rabbi, taught us, Ikar Avodat HaMatkilim VeChoshvei Shmo Uvo Tidbar, the major thing of the enlightened one, and those who know His name, the Choshvei Shmo, those who think about His name, God's name, Uvo Tidbachem. The major work that one is supposed to engage in is Uvo Tidbachem Dvekut. Dvekut is cleaving. Dvekut is adhesion. You're supposed to cleave and to, what's the verb? Adhere? Adhere, thank you, adhere to the divine name. Veze klal gadol shebatorah, latfila velabrachot, להסכים מחשבתו באמונתו כאילו דווקא למעלה, לחבר את השם באותיותיו. And it is a great rule in the Torah, in the תפילה, and in the ברכות, להסכים מחשבתו באמונתו, to have his mind in it and his belief, כאילו דווקא למעלה, לחבר את השם באותיותיו. One should imagine himself in his thought, in his belief, like he is adhering upward in order to put together the name with his letters. לחבר את השם באותיותיו ולכלול בו עשר ספירות, and to integrate into it the tenth sphere כשלהבת קשורה בזחלת, like a flame in the coals, בפיו יזכירנו בכינויו ובליבו יחברנו בבניינו ובכתבו. When you say out loud, you should say only the kinui, like Adonai or Elohim. In your heart, בליבו יחברנו בבניינו ובכתבו. In your heart, not saying it aloud, you should think and contemplate on the ineffable name in its structure and in design. Now this is an example of the language which is initiated in those circles. Rabbi Ezra Baal Perush Shir HaShirim, who is a direct student of Rabbi Yitzchak Sabinaho. It is Perush Shir HaShirim of Rabbi Ezra. The idea which is mentioned here is the centrality of the ineffable name in the divine worship. Usually we are not supposed to say the ineffable name. It's none of our business to speak it out or to contemplate on it. But that's exactly what they are asking. They say that the Mekubalim is supposed to contemplate on the ineffable name, because the ineffable name is the center of the divine language. The divine language is the construction of the world. All of that is related to what they think on the language of Sefer Yetzirah. But that's only half the story, the beginning of the story. The language and speculation on the language and divine name is the framework of it. But the story behind it is the story of a crisis in the heaven. A crisis in heaven. That they did not take from Sefer Yetzirah. Sefer Yetzirah is a harmonious book. Sefer Yetzirah knows nothing about catastrophe, about crisis, because it was written in the early, probably, as I said, before the destruction of the temple. It was written in the first century of the first millennium. But when they study, thousands of years later, they think of it within a different framework. The framework that they have in mind is a catastrophe in heaven, a catastrophe in divinity, a catastrophe and tragedy in heaven, which is a reflection of the catastrophe on earth. That hasn't been before. That's a new thing. We had heavenly temples before in Nephilot literature. We had angelic names and divine names plenty in Nephilot literature. We had priestly angels and angel priests before in Nephilot literature. We didn't have the idea of crisis in heaven, tragedy in heaven. We may want to ask, what is the context of it? What is the reason that that thing had happened? The answer is, the crusaders are besieging Jerusalem and conquering Jerusalem and reinstituting the throne of David. The Kabbalists are taking exactly the same thing. Jerusalem, the throne of David, the temple, only they project it all on heaven and they connect it all to the tenth sphere. In order to show how much, to what extent, the Crusaders' world has to do with the new language, I want to read to you one verse that was told by the Archbishop of Jerusalem. Archbishop of Jerusalem to the camp of the Crusaders goes as following. I'll read it in Hebrew and then I'll translate it. Chovateinu leitpalel. Our duty is to pray, says the Archbishop, the Christian Archbishop of Jerusalem. Chovateinu leitpalel vechovatchem lehakot ba'amalekim. Our duty is to pray, and you, the Crusaders, your duty is to beat the Amalekim, the enemies which are called Amalek. Anu nisai Moshe kapeinu abilti nil'ot betfila l'shamayim. We are going to raise our hands with Moses to heaven, like in the priestly blessing. We are going to raise our hands to heaven. בתפילה לשמיים, in prayer to heaven, אתם לוחמים ללוחה, תנעשו חרבכם בעמלק. You, the brave warriors, will use your sword against the enemy known as Amalek. Further, another one of the bishops in the time of the crusade said on the crusaders, we are Bnei Israel היוצאים ממצרים, אשר לאחר עוברם את ים סוף, כבשו בכוח משכן את הארץ בהנהגת ישו. הן פרפיגורציה שלכם. את היבוסים ושאר העממים גרשו משם וישבו את ירושלים השמימית בדמות ירושלים האחת. We are the children of Israel who depart from Egypt, that after they crossed the Red Sea, conquered with the power of their weapon the Holy Land under the leadership of Jesus. They, the Israelites, are your prefiguration, you, the crusaders. The Jebusites and the other people who dwelled in the land, they vanished from there. And they settled Jerusalem, the heavenly Jerusalem, in the shape of the one Jerusalem. This, again, is one of the crusaders' leaders, religious leaders, lecture. Those two examples are two among hundreds. That was the language that was introduced in the crusaders' time. They were the Israelites. They were led by Moses, Jesus, according to their perception. They were taking over Jerusalem, the earthly and the heavenly. At the very same time, in the very same vicinity, the very same ideas are adopted by the Jews within a Kabbalistic context. They also see themselves as engaging in taking over Jerusalem. Only they are not doing it with swords, they are not doing it with war, they are doing it with prayer, and they are doing it in order to rectify the beaten Jerusalem, the destructed Jerusalem, the desolated Jerusalem. The very same thing that the crusade is inaugurating around is the very same thing that Kabbalah is starting from. Now, the question is not who affected whom. The question is that in a certain historical period, there are ideas or focus of intellectual discourse which are in the air. In the first centuries of the second millennium, there is no doubt that Jerusalem is in the center of the conversation. That taking over earthly Jerusalem as well as heavenly Jerusalem is the focus of the crusade. They call it in this way. They're talking in that way. They say that they are the prefigurations of the Israelites. Now you can imagine how did the Jews say. The Christians say that Amalek that they are fighting against are the Muslims. For the Jews, Amalek that they are praying for its defeat are the Christians. The city that they are praying for thousands of years, Jerusalem, had turned to be the focus of crusaders' Christendom. We have the same focus, the same mental focus, the same geographical focus, the same religious focus, in the midst of the discourse of two fighting religions. Now, the Jews could not say a word outwardly. They couldn't say anything. They are living as a minority, as a persecuted minority, in the middle of Christian France and Christian Spain. They couldn't say a word. There was a great deal of religious tension as it is. But they could, and they did, discuss it within biblical language, within midrashic language, within hymns. They didn't fight it. It was too dangerous. They wrote it only quietly, as hymns. They taught it by heart. Kabbalah starts, second millennium Kabbalah, starts with Rabbi Yitzchak Sagina Hor telling us that it is the heavenly seat which is broken. The heavenly temple is broken. The desolated Shekhinah is captured. Now if you think about it, in the ancient images, of those things, immediately you would understand how the world of spirits was connected to them. The concept that the crusaders were talking time and again is Malchut Beth David. When they, if you open any book of the Crusaders, they are reinstituting the seat of David, the kingdom of David. They are, of course, Jesus is the inheritor of the seat of David. The Jews said Malchut instead of saying the whole verse, Malchut Beth David. They make it to one word, Malchut. Malchut is the lowest sphere, the hemisphere. Malchut is the Shechina. Malchut is the kingdom. Malchut is the crown. Malchut is the daughter of Zion. All of that is together. The very same symbol, which is developed in Sefer Abahir, which is developed in Sefer Yetzirah, about the ten spheres. Each one of the spheres has metaphors and symbols. Malchut is the best known sphere. That's the lowest one. It's number 10. And it is the reflection at one at the same time of the community of Israel, of the daughter of Zion, of the Shechina, of Malchut Beth David. And in one word it is called Malchut, or it is called Atara, or it is called Shechina. But it's all the same. All the symbols are concentrated there. I can't hear you. Well, kingdom is the word for the kingdom of David. That's the point I'm making. We always say Malchut and translating it to kingdom, but we forget that when you say kingdom, it's Beth David, it's Malchut Beth David. The very same concept that the Crusaders are putting in the midst of their voyage. Where they're going to Jerusalem is to reinstitute the seat of David, the throne of David, the house of David. That's the way they see. When the Kabbalists in southern France are talking on Sfirat Malchut, they also talk on Malchut Beth David. Only they project all of it on heaven. They don't do anything on earth. They do it on heaven. They imagine that the heavenly temple, which is a reflection of Jerusalem and reflection of Jewish history and reflection of the Bible and reflection of the seat of David, all of this has been conquered by evil powers. Now, in the Crusaders' vocabulary, as you could hear, they are using Amalek, they are using Beth David. They're using Malchut, and then you know the king was called Melech Yerushalayim. That's the way they call the Crusaders. Somebody from the French. The Crusaders are adopting those ideas: the Amalek, the Beth David, the Malchut, Yerushalayim. All of that is their adopted vocabulary. Now, at the very same time, in the very same place, we have exactly the same vocabulary in the words of the first Kabbalist verse. What they do is, they connect to the heritage of the mystical Vikings, to the ten spheres, to Sefer Yetzirah, to Sefer Abahir, to the name of God, and they rework something entirely new. Now, this something new is composed of the following. The divine language is the common denominator between heaven and earth. Just like the divine language is creating on earth, people who are using the divine language may affect heaven. The common... The idea of Sefer Abahir, the major idea of the book Abahir, that was completely an innovation, was the vision of heaven. Where was it? The vision of heaven and earth in a dual language. As I said time and again, there is no duality in the Book of Creation. Book of Creation is harmonious. It's complete perception how everything is connected to everything. The language is the weaving power or the network under the language. The divine language is the network under everything in existence. On the other side, Sefer Abahir is telling us that everything is divided. That's the innovation of Sefer HaBriyot.
Isn't that
your
claim?
I can't hear you.
Isn't that your claim?
Well, it might well be. However, Sefer HaBriyot does not introduce itself as Neoplatonism. It introduces itself as Midrash. It might very well be taken from Neoplatonism or where else, although we don't really know where did it take it. Some say it's Gnostic, some say it's Neoplatonic. Why would you say it's Neoplatonic?
I mean, I read the Bible, which is struck me as Neoplatonic teaching in the Midrash of John.
Well, some scholars think that it reflects Gnostic approaches. Some think it's Midrashic, some think it's Neoplatonic. And I say it might very well be all of that, but when we come down to the question, what do we know from Sefer HaBriyot that we didn't know before? The one thing that you can say is utterly new, is the division between two poles, in divinity, on earth, in heaven, in human thinking. That duality hasn't been introduced before. We can argue what are the sources, we cannot argue on the fact that it introduced a new frame of thinking.
Well, I mean, it existed in Islam, and that's not...
But one cannot say that Sefer HaBriyot is a philosophical book, right?
I don't know.
Well, no, I can say it. One cannot say that Sefer HaBriyot is a philosophical book. It does not introduce itself as a philosophy. It introduces itself as a midrash. It's important. The way books introduce itself. Philosophical book would start by Aristotle said so, Plato said so, Ibn Rushd said so, Avicenna said so. They don't. They say Rabbi Nachunya ben Akana said, and that's no philosophy. They would say Rabbi Elazar Hochan would say, this is not philosophy. That's a midrashic way of thinking. But when we ask, what is it that Sefer HaBriyot is telling us that we didn't do before, that we didn't know before? And that philosophy doesn't tell us either. It tells us that the deity is divided to male and female. That the world is divided to Satan side and sacred side. That the souls are divided between good souls and evil souls. There is a polarity, there is a duality that is first introduced by Sefer HaBriyot. We don't know that systematic polarity between good and evil, male and female, light, darkness, in this midrashic sense. This is something that they take from Sefer HaBriyot. Whenever they are speaking on catastrophe in heaven, on crisis in heaven, the building blocks are taken from Sefer HaBriyot in one way, from Sefer Yetzirah in another way, but they introduce something that hasn't been there or here. They introduce this sense of crisis in the deity, a crisis that puts people on the position of being recruited to rectify. That's what Kabbalah is about. That hasn't been told before. Now, any person who is engaging Kabbalah, and Kabbalah is very multiform, but anyone who is engaged in Kabbalah has the following foundation. Rabbi Yitzchak Savi Nahor and his students, which are going now showing up to Spain and spreading the word, were teaching that there is a tragedy in heaven. Ein Hashem Shalem ve'ein Hakiseh Shalem. The name of God is not whole. The throne is not whole. The heavenly temple is not whole. All of them are broken. All of them are under catastrophe. All of them are in crisis. Now what I want you to know is that at the very same time, the same vocabulary is being used by the crusaders who are winning. For them, they are on the course of winning. They are winning Jerusalem and they are rebuilding their own perception of the temple and they are reinstituting the king of Jerusalem, which is called the king from the house of David. The crusaders are appropriating the whole entire Jewish vocabulary, biblical vocabulary, and they introduce it as theirs. The Jews are responding by saying, none of what you say has any veracity. For us, this is no throne of David that you have in Jerusalem. Our throne of David is in heaven, but it's broken. Our temple is in heaven, but it's cursed. Those words, our Malchut, our kingdom, our Jerusalem, our Bethlehem, it's all God. But what they do? They pass by the name of God. And they add to that the temple. And they add to that the house of David. And they say that all of them, and there is apathy, are suffering and broken and misplaced. And the people, when they pray and when they study, should try to clean them together, to work them together. The separation is demonstrated in numerous metaphors and things. The separation is like if there are four letters of the name of God, one letter is missing. If the temple is perceived as having walls and doors and trees and all that, the temple is missing certain parts, the heavenly temple. The house of David was presented by Shirat Malchut. It captures, it follows. Now when we are praying, and when we are studying, and when we are engaged in any religious command, we suppose now by enunciating. The new one is called Kavanot, Kavanot Atfila. Kavanot is intention. The two words are introduced here. Kavanot Veikubin. Kavanot means intention in the prayer. Veikubin means unification. What you should do? You should unify the separated. You should intend to rectify the broken name, the broken temple, the broken baby. The tragedy, all of what was considered to be, I want you to understand that carefully, all what considered to be eternal, ineffable, omnipotent, is now depicted as fragile, desolated, distant, separated. It's upon humans to rectify the situation. Only humans can do the unification, the intention. All what they are doing is the Bekut. The Bekut means addition, cleaving, and it also means to put together. I want you to remember that the origins of the word davar, the word davar, is alkeni azov ish et avi ve'imo ודבח באשתו והיו לבשר אחד. The union, the physical union, the physical unification is the metaphor of the truth. It's the togetherness of the separated. Now that is projected on human. Yichud is also, in Hebrew, if we like the wedding night, is led Yichud. The Yichud, the physical togetherness, is projected as heavenly togetherness. And there are numerous other words of that kind. The putting together, uniting, is what we have to do in our mind, because all that is separated. The word separated or divorced or desolated, all those words, or captive, all those words are now projected on the heavenly sphere. It is upon humans to try to rectify the situation. That's what makes it work for in the dark on the side. It is the tragedy in heaven on one side and the human obligation on the other side. They are saying this quietly. They don't publicize it. They pick certain people to initiate them into it. The person who is in charge is Yitzhak Sadinako, but the atmosphere which is being built is very interesting atmosphere. It is the atmosphere of Avelei Tzion. They see themselves as mourners on the broken temple. They see themselves as people who are pushing. Now the word pushing is a very interesting word. Parush can be parush me and parush mufrash le. Parush me is being aside from this word. Like parush is a person who says, I'm detaching myself from this world, from worldly concerns. But it also is mufrash le. Someone who is chosen to devote himself to work, to life of started to life of devotion, to life of prayer. This is the first time that we have good historical evidence that in the end of the 12th century, in the beginning of the 13th century, a new group of people called Krushim, Mafrishim Atman Mileida, they are chosen by their father, where they are like Ma'aser or chosen. They are chosen by certain families. They are chosen by their father to study all their life. They start to study as the usual course of people, but from the age of 16 until the age of 23, they are taking an oath that they are not to leave at all the house of study. They are pushing. We have a very interesting text called Chukei Torah, published in the book of Gideman, the Toldot Yehudim, the Nebuchadnezzar. It's a text from the 12th, 13th century describing the life of those Krushim. We are told that they are Mafrishim Atman Me'olam Hazeh, they are putting themselves aside, detaching themselves from any worldly concern. They are committed and devoted to study day and night, to pray day and night. Those people, those students, are those who are living life of mourners on the temple, and they are concentrating in prayer and intention and devotion. This is a new vocabulary. We don't have those words in the earlier. This new vocation, this new vocabulary, is identified here. Now, I want you to pay attention. In the same time and in the same place, something similar is taking place within the German Jewish community of Hasidei Ashkenaz. Don't mix it with later 18th century Hasidim. It's a different story. I'm talking on 13th century Hasidei Ashkenaz. The word Hasid means pious, means devoted. Devoted, pious, a person who is devoting all his life to extraordinary way of life. You don't live like according to Torah or Mitzvot, that's Shita. You are taking upon yourself thousands of other restrictions in order to spend an ordinary life in a spiritual mode which is different than a usual existential mode. Those people in Germany called Hasidim, like the servants of Yehudah Hasid. Those people in France are called Krushim the Hasidim, or Hasidim the Krushim, devoted and ascetic. In those circles, and only amongst them, those ideas are grown. Their practice is grown. I want you to understand that the historical situation inside the Jewish community and outside in the world, in the Christian world, is the powers which affect the formation of this new consciousness. So we have books like Sefer Yetzirah and Sefer Abahir, who offers vocabulary, and Perush Sefer Yetzirah of Rabbi Abraham, of Rabbi Yehuda Barceloni, which offers a great many midrashim on those topics. That's the vocabulary, the written vocabulary. We have the new prophetic spiritual insights in those Batei Midrash of Krushim and Hasidim, which are directed by the family of Abraham ben David, Abraham ben Yitzchak Sadi Nahor, Asher ben David. Those authorities are directing those study houses, which have inner circles of devotee and ascetic. Within those circles of devotees and ascetic, those new ideas of broken deity, broken divinity, shattered temple, desolated Shechina, that's where they start. And I want to add to all that the fact that the same vocabulary is being adopted by the Christians in the Crusades on the same time with the great difference. They are succeeding immensely while the Jews are being murdered. They are very successful in the overconquering of Jerusalem and instituting the reign of David and seeing themselves as the true Israelites and so on. While the Jews are being assassinated in the course of the Crusades, while any kind of salvation is very far. But the way that they respond to all of that is that they develop a new mystical vocabulary. Now, as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't matter at all if we say that it has to do with Neoplatonic ideas or with Gnostic ideas. I think that what's important is what are the texts which are available for them. The whole library is available for them. But they choose to talk in the language of Sefer Yetzirah, in the language of Sefer Hagadah. They don't speak in others. They speak in Midrash language, in Sefer Abahir language, in Sefer Yetzirah language. They are telling us a new dualism that we were not familiar with. They are talking here now on Amalek, on Samael, on Sifra Afra, as the name of the evil power that caused the destruction. Amalek, Samael, Sifra Afra. Amalek, of course, is the biblical name of this force. What we know about why Amalek more than others? Why, for instance, we use Amalek and not Yebusim? Because of the verse. Ki milchama la'Adonai ve'Amalek midor ledor. When the Israelites with Moses are on the desert, there is a big fight. Joshua is taking the actual fight, and Moshe, what does Moshe do? Like that. He lifts his hands to heaven. That's exactly what the Mekubalim are asking the people to do. Lift your mind, lift your hands of the mind to heaven in Birkat Kohanim and pray for the success of the divine powers against the Amalek powers. That's exactly what they do. They adopt the ancient biblical vocabulary and metaphor, where the evil side is called Amalek, and where the leader is Moses, and where the way of fighting is the priesthood, you know, yes, to Israel is meant with the priesthood. That is, they do exactly the same in their mind, and that's how they say. And there, the very same place, which most, where we have the verse, Ki yad al kef yad, ve'en ha-kifre shalem, ve'en ha-shem shalem, this whole intricacy of verses referring to the fact that this throne is not whole, and the name is not whole, because Amalek is overpowered. So the war, the biblical war between Adonai and Amalek, between God and his or between the Jews on one side and evil powers on the other side, is adopted in the Crusader period. And they take the whole structure and they project it into heaven. They are not doing anything on earth. They are no soldiers, they have no battalions, they have no commanders. They do spiritual work, and they are doing it within that world of peace. Okay? Yes, Alan, you want to go?
If they want to reach out to God,
They want to
reach out to God in their body.
Yes.
Why would it be that in Sefer HaKadim, among Akhenaten, they stop doing this blessing or reservation?
Well, because they say that only certain people are supposed to do it on a daily basis and not others. They wanted, because they're using the Birkat Kohanim as a weapon, they didn't want it to be a usual thing. They keep it to the exclusive service. By the way, later on, when the Hasidim in 18th century want to resume these pietistic ways of life, among the things they do are the Chadshim Birkat Kohanim b'chol yom. Like in Frankfurt, 18th century, Rabbi Nathan Adler, the brother of Chatam Sofer, is renewing the idea of doing Birkat Kohanim with Haramat Safayim every day and in a very fastidious way and all that. So it's part of this ancient history of making certain ritual acts according to the biblical pattern, according to Moses' leadership, as a part of a struggle. This is not only blessing, it's a struggle. There is a struggle between one side and the other side. But the important thing is to understand how the historical experience is translated into mystical experience when on history you can do nothing. On the historical existential vicinity you can do nothing. No Jew could say anything against any crusaders, let alone thousands, hundred thousands of crusaders, let alone against those who conquered Jerusalem and defeated their bulls in Melech Yerushalayim on the throne of David and so on and so forth. They couldn't do anything. They could not intervene in any way on this earthly arena. They could and they did shape a wonderful new mystical perception of what's going on in heaven. In heaven there is a battle, there is a tragedy, there is a desolation and all that, but it's the people who pray and intend and commit themselves who are changing the situation. They adopt the biblical worldview, like Moshe is blessing, and as a result of his blessing, the battle is taking shape. Like the idea of Adonai Lachem Lachem V'atem Sacharishun, the heavenly world is what's reflected on earth, and it's us, by sharing, by participating, who are shaping it. Yes.
The quote from Ezra on Midrash Bar, on Pirush Shirshirim,
yeah.
He talks about a visual meditation, and I'm wondering where that's coming from. It's like a common practice.
Well, one second. He said, אמר רבנו החסידים, עיקר עבודת המשכילים וחושבי שמו ובו תדבק. That's not video, that's like clip. וזה כלל גדול שבתורה לתפילה ולברכות, להשים מחשבתו באמונתו כאילו דווקא למעלה, לחבר את השם באותיותה. It's all intellectual, spiritual engagement. ולכלול בו עשר ספירות כשלבת קשורה בגחלת, בפיו יזכירנו, בכינויו ובלבבו יחברנו, בבניינו ובכתבו. That's what he said. I don't know if one could say particularly visual or one can think of it as audible, I'm not sure. But it's obvious that the name of God is in the focus of the intention. I call it Kavanot, as we call it as the Kut or Kavanot or Yehudi, because that's the language that there is.
But it's not just during prayer.
I'm sorry?
That's not just during prayer. That's all the time, right?
Well, the general thing is Kavanot HaTfila. The general framework is Kavanot HaTfila. Now, when people are praying, they're supposed to, when they pray, to put a particular effort in joining together the separated different things. Now, who is separated? Tiferet from Malchut, Bina from Malchut, right side from left side, upper from lower. The different distinctions which were first offered in the Bahir in a systematic way are now adopted as part of the prayer intention in order to put together those which are before. I want to read you one more quotation. Ubehiyot Israel Bagalut, Ena Kiseh Shalem, Ki Advarim Mitkashim Be'atzman, ואין בהם דבקות רוח הקודש ממעל, לפי שהוא מסתלק ועולה למרום מרומים. ובהיות ישראל על אדמתם, הדברים כמו כן על מכונם, והכיסא שלם. ומתעלים למעלה לקבל מהקצרים ומן התשובה, והכל מתעלה בדבקות עד כתר עליון, הנקרא קודש. That's another quotation of רבי עזרא, and the name of רבי יצחק קדינאו. I'll translate. When Israel is in exile, this throne is not whole. אין הכיסא שלם. ובהיות ישראל בגלות, אין הכיסא שלם. When the Israelites are on exile, this throne of God is not whole. God. כי הדברים מתפשטים בעצמם, ואין בהם דבקות רוח הקודש. Things are spreading by themselves, and there is no adhesion of the Holy Spirit from above. לפי שהוא מסתלק ועולה. The Holy Spirit is ascending and running away. מסתלק ועולה. למרום מרומים. Something is ascending up and returning. Where it shouldn't be. To the uppermost. And in other places they would say that some are returning upwards and some are falling downwards. There is like different metaphors, but there would always be something which is not in place. It could be either going upwards or either going downwards, or falling or ascending, but it's not in place in harmony with the Kibbutz. לפי שהוא מסתלק ועולה למרום מרומים. ובהיות ישראל על אדמתם, והדברים כמו כן על מכונם. When the Israelites were on their country, the things were on their place. והכיסא שלם, and the throne is whole. ומתעלים למעלה לקבל מהקצרים. When the Israelites were on their country, everything is whole. What's supposed to be going up is going up. לקבל מהקצרים. To receive from the fearful קצרים and from the תשובה. from the repentance. When things are in harmony, everything is ascending harmoniously until the sphere of Keter, until the sphere of the upper crown, Keter Elyon and Mikra Kodesh. Everything is adhering or ascending in place until Keter Elyon. There are numerous sections like this. All of them are referring in one way or another to a sentence start, Ubeyot Israel Vagalut Enatite Shalom. When the Israelites are out of their place, the throne of God is not whole. It's missing, it's broken, it's shattered, and it goes from the yes. I'm reading from Meirat 9, the edition of Amos Goldreich, pages 86-87, quotation of Rabbi Eshet. All of this, the idea of the exile of the Shekhinah, or the idea of the broken throne, or the idea of the shattered temple, they are all synonyms of the same historical experience. So, of all what I said, I want you to remember that the historical existential experience of exile is now projected into heaven. But it's the Kabbalah who starts the idea that the heavenly exile, reflecting the earthly exile, should be responded by people who are starting to rectify, to intend like intention, kavanot, who are involved in adhering to the kut, in cleaving the kut. They are active participants of mending the broken world, of mending the shattered throne, of mending the desolated temple. Yeah, but are we told anywhere that it's upon us to save the Shekhinah? Are we told anywhere? Well, I think that we probably can find it is all there in different factors, but it is not a system of thought. It becomes to be a system of thought and a system of practice. Only in the Kabbalistic circle. I absolutely agree that we can find roots and channels and concepts and phrases in previous literature. No doubt. We can find it in the Mishnah, we can find it in the Talmud, we can find it in the Midrash, we can find it in the Yetziran, etc. All the library is open to all those people who are devoted all their time to study. The one thing which is new is taking all those things and weave them into a new system of thought and a new system of action. Those people are taking all those components and say the heavenly temple evolved. The heavenly seat or the heavenly throne is shattered. The heavenly name is missing. All of that, of course, we can track the sources of it, but nowhere we can find the continuation. It is upon you to pray, to intend, to adhere, to stay, to ligol, to solve, all those things are not known before. It is the change of thought from passive to active that is introduced by the Kabbalah. Now it's active in the spiritual level. It is active by the initiate. It is active by people who are committed to the idea of Geulat Shekhinah. So we have here a reverse. It's not the people who are only passive waiters, those who wait, mechakim. They are not only those who are waiting passively to the changing of history. It is active participants in the historical scene where things are happening through the spiritual underlying picture, okay? If we understand that principle, we understand what is that it is about. In order to come to this point, we have to understand the concept of the culture of all the mystical things. It is based on the following assumption. Beyond the hidden text, beyond the revealed text, there is a hidden text. Beyond history, there is metaphysics. Beyond human experience on the existential plane, there is a hidden scheme which we don't see, but that's what they're resting. beyond the mitzvah tefracha of the test, there is a hidden tefracha. So every aspect of human life, history, sexuality, existential experience, lingual experience, beyond every revealed aspect of human life, there is a hidden tefracha which could be learned, deciphered, manipulated, shared by the people who are participating. Okay, so we have here a point of departure which says, beyond what you experience on the chaotic existence that you can do nothing about, there is a whole tefracha that you can do a lot about in the hidden spiritual space. We may call it compensation very well. Compensation is it. But it's not only compensation. It's an avenue of action which was given for people who were denied any capacity to change reality. The only place where they could change reality was within the hidden world. And there they were engaging in it enthusiastically, believing that it is the inner reality that makes the difference, and it's in the inner reality that they are changing. And all the same, remember that this celebration of the inner reality is taking place while the outward reality is heavily stamped by similar ideas which have political incredible ramifications. So the Jews are dealing with mystical, spiritual interpretation of what's going on, while the Gentiles are involved in actual changes. But who would remain? Who would succeed in the end? They believe that those who understand the hidden components of reality would prevail. The outer reality is changing and being forgotten. The inner reality is transmitted, is cherished, is taught, is informing the mentality and the way of thinking. They are fighting on the inner reality. They're not fighting on the outer reality. As I said, those things are taught to be initiated. It's called Chokmat HaNistar. It's the wisdom of the secret. They don't teach it to the public. They keep it in esoteric circles. However, when you start those things and you keep it esoterically, soon enough somebody will say, well, now is the time to put it forth. So we start, the very first stage is the conventual Kabbalah, which is esoteric. The house of, we say, Abraham ben Yitzchak Bala Ishkol, Abraham ben David Bala Sagot, Yitzchak Sabina Ho, the author of Perush Sefer Yetzirah, his students, Rabbi Ezra, Rabbi Azriel, we start there, in the turn of the 12th to the 13th century. Soon enough, the esoteric perception, supported by the Beit Midrash of Purushim, by the people who are devoted for 7 years of not leaving the study house, being engaged in study and prayer, in order to help to rescue the captive Shekhinah, in order to help to be priests who are serving in the heavenly temple. All those things are taking a turn when the students of Rabbi Ezra and Rabbi Azriel, who are very enthusiastic about those things, they say, we wish to write down those things. We are afraid that we will forget them. We are not as gifted as our teachers who could memorize it all. We want to write it down. So, in Catalonia, that's in Spain, a new state is being inaugurated. They are teaching it in such a way that writing is possible. Now they say in the following way, we are writing perushim, we are writing treaties or interpretation around the biblical text. We write perushim leshir hashirim, we write perushim leagadot, we write perushim leTanakh. They take the old traditional system of the perushim, but in those perushim they infuse those new ideas. So in Perush Shir HaShirim of Rabbi Ezra, it's entirely Kabbalistic text. In Perush HaAgadot of Rabbi Azriel, it's entirely Kabbalistic vocabulary. In Perush HaRambam El HaTorah, there are hints of this new vocabulary. They are writing it down. They didn't do it in Provence. They do it in Catalonia. When they write it down and they teach students, some of the students are enthusiastic about it, and they are teaching it in this truth. Now, from this period, we have a very interesting correspondence of two kinds. One is very negative and one is very apprehensive. Rav Meir ben Shimon of Narbona is writing a very negative criticism. He said, what are you doing? You are praying to different powers in heaven. You are doing blasphemous things. Maybe you intend well, but what you do is evil. Because what do they say? What prayer should look like? They say that first three portions of the Shmoneh Esrei should be addressed to the, let's say, the three upper spheres. The middle portions should be addressed to the sixth sphere. The last three should be addressed to the lower sphere, or vice versa. Anyhow, they give exact instructions how you should do that. Intention, unification, and each in regard to the different portions of each one. You say the same old benedictions, but when you say them out loud, you should think on the name, on putting together the divine name, which in turn is referring to each one of the symbols. The first letter of the divine name is referring to the Sirat Keter, to the upper three. Sphere number 10, the highest sphere. The second one is referring to Bina, to the next three spheres. The Vav is referring to the sixth sphere, from Tiferet downward, and the last one, the last K, is referring to Malchut. It doesn't matter to remember all of them, but in the divine name, the four letters are referring to the tenth sphere, to the upper one, to the next three ones, to the sixth, and to the last one. So they say when you do the prayer, you should... No, as I said, there are ten, there are not 11. The Keter... So one of them is overlapped. But it doesn't matter if... The structure is, they give the exact counting. Yeah, it doesn't matter. The principle matters. Okay? The idea is that when you pray, each one of the benedictions should be responding to a certain power in heaven. You should elevate this heavenly power. You should put it together. You should think that it should be cleaving one to the other. It should be do the opposite of separation, the opposite of divorce, the opposite of revelation. It should be unification, adhesion, togetherness, while the spheres are desolated, divorced, and so on and so forth. So the very process of prayer, which people are engaged daily, is a process of unification, is a process of mystical adhesion, is a process of restitution. So it's the same prayer that you always do, but now it has entirely new meaning. As I said, there are two responses. One is by Rav Meir ben Shimon Minarbona, who says, what you do is blasphemous. What you do is ruining the ancient tradition of our Holy Father. You should not pray like this. You should not pray like this. You should not intend like this. There is very severe criticism. Where? Well, if you take the book of Shalom, Rashita Kabbalah, the Sefer Avahir in Hebrew, or Origins of Kabbalah in English, or in the volume on Igeret Teuda Chadasha Lefeker HaKabbalah in the Bialik book, you will find it all. In every chapter on the beginning of Kabbalah, this is a very famous document, because this is the first historical response of a critical kind. That somebody says what you do is wrong. The second one is the response of Rabbi Yitzchak Kadinahor. He is writing an apprehensive letter to his students. He says, you shouldn't have thought it outwardly. Myself and my fathers, who were the notable of the land, the noble of the land, were always talking secretly. We never meant it to be a public affair, and this is true. As I said, they kept it esoteric. But the nature of study, when you start to teach something, it can never really be completely esoteric. He wanted to keep it esoteric because he was afraid that it would be misinterpreted. Their intentions were utterly positive. Since they viewed heaven as suffering, they wanted the people to pray to help mankind. Since they thought that the kingdom is desolated, they wanted those who pray to elevate it and to unify it and so on and so forth. In order to understand what they do, we need to understand their perception. For them, the point of departure is that a tragedy, a crisis has happened in the heavenly sphere. And if this is the position, you must engage in helping. You are involved in Pidyon Shvuim. You are involved in restituting the broken world, the broken name or the broken temple. It's all similar. They have numerous metaphors for that, but the picture is the same picture. Something has been terribly broken, and it's upon these people the responsibility to rectify the situation.
Compartmentalizing the direction of the tefillah, and doesn't that divide it more than unite it? I mean, before people think about it, they just stop in one direction. Now you have a mail system where you have to try to direct the traffic.
Well, you're supposed to direct the combination, the togetherness, the adhesion, the yachad, of those which are separated in heaven. The point of departure is that it's separation. We start, before we start to pray, we have to realize that some of these fears went up, some of these fears went down. There is something wrong going on. As I said time and again, the heavenly temple or God's name or the seat of David or the throne, it's all, you know, it's all interchanged all the time. But it's all separated. So prayer becomes the act of unification. In the prayer, you try to rectify the separation. That's what they mean, that's what they intend. Their critic says, why are they praying to different powers in heaven? It's not what they do. They don't pray to different powers. They view the divinity, as we know from the book of Habakkuk, as built for different dimensions. The deity itself is like a focus, and it is combined of various dimensions. Those dimensions are called midot, sefirot, attributes, man. You can call them whatever you want, but they are the dimensions of the revealed deity in one way or another, the creative power of deity. But those creative powers, which could be called spirit, midot, or attributes, from a certain moment in the mystical thinking, are not harmonically working, but are tragically separated. This is the point of departure of mystical thinking. If you don't understand that, there is nothing else to understand. They need to rectify the tragedy. That's what they are doing. That's what they are seeking. That's what they are involved. And they recruit numerous metaphors in order to understand it. I suggest to understand it as the historical tragedy on earth, known as exile, is projected on heaven. And they say, Achav Yisrael Bagalut Ena Kiseh Shalem Ve'Ena Shem Shalem, they say it very, very bluntly. It's the exile in history which should be understood as a reflection of the crisis in heaven, not vice versa. It's the heavenly crisis which is reflected in the historical exile. In order to change anything on the historical exile, we have to mend the heavenly crisis. There is nothing we're supposed to do on earth. We're supposed to mend the heavenly crisis. That's what they are doing. That's what they are engaged in. So, okay?
The other question is that we have to square that philosophically with the notion that the divinity requires human assistance.
That's what Kabbalah is about. The definition of Kabbalah is divinity that is in reciprocal relation with humans. Reciprocal relations is the human assistance to divine tragedy. That's really the meaning of it. That's the basis of it. Because of that, we're working on it and we're talking on it, and we'll have an opportunity to see that it goes on. Now, there are numerous Kabbalistic schools. There's not only one. But Kabbalah starts there. In that moment, when they say that the war of God and the Amalek is the status of the thing. Exile is when the Amalek is overpowering. We are on exile. That means that the war is going on and the good powers are losing or not succeeding. It's upon us to help to the good powers. That's what Kabbalah is about. That's what the Bekut and the Houdini and Kavanaugh is what they're doing. That is what they are putting themselves for. But we have to understand this dualistic situation that they view in heaven, which is really the projection of exile and redemption on earth. They want to be redeemed. They want to be free. They want to be people who have a land like everybody else. But they are exiled. They are sovereignless. They are persecuted. They are banished. They are exiled in every century. They have every reason to feel the depth of the tragedy of exile.
Is there a point that
should
not redemption spiritual?
Well, they consider redemption as a process, not as a moment, as a process.
In other words,
we
have spiritual redemption and not spiritual.
Well, they see all of that we're talking now on the heavenly plane, right? Whatever they're doing right now is directed towards the heavenly plane. It's a process. It's not a one action. In the process of restitution, rectification, unification, in the process of mending the broken divinity, then redemption will come. But it's upon us to engage in the process. They're always hoping and waiting for the historical reflection of it, but they don't believe in any historical reflection before spiritual something process will take place. Okay? So what we have here is a dialectical system. The historical experience of exile, very real exile on earth, and very deep, profound yearning of redemption on earth. There is not a Jew who was not hoping for redemption in the medieval ages. In the Crusaders' time, in the time of the expulsion from England and expulsion from France and the expulsion from Germany, they have been expelled and banished and charged every century. Exile was very, very strong experience. They were yearning for redemption. The point which makes the Kabbalah so important to understand is that this is the active participation of humans in changing the circumstances. Since they believe that all of that is taking place in heaven, first and foremost, and on the earthly level, it's only a reflection of what's going on in heaven. It's on the heavenly field that it should be changed and rectified and mended. When it would be mended on the heavenly field through human health, then redemption would come also on the earthly thing. It's like one big cycle. It's like the cow field, you know. If you would do this and that here, it would affect this and that there. They engage themselves in helping the deity. They consider the deity as projection of their own experience. While they are desolated, the deity is desolated. While the temple on earth is shattered, the heavenly temple is shattered. While there is no priesthood on earth serving in the temple, there is no priesthood serving angels in the heavenly temple. They really take the basic experience of the people on earth, projecting it in detail on heaven, and recruit the people to make the change and the difference. Okay? That's the scheme of the method. There are numerous metaphors and symbols to elucidate. But this is the principle. It's not hard to understand because it's human experience, which is very tragic, which is serving to understand the background of Kabbalistic literature. When you ask yourself, why there is so much Kabbalistic literature, why there are thousands of pages, the answer is because there is so much exile, because there is so much yearning for redemption. I said to begin with, and I return on that, mysticism is written by people who lose on earth and cannot make any change on it. It's only on the heavenly plane that they can change, and they are devoted to that, they are committed to that, they recruit themselves to that. And that point of departure, we start as esoteric speaking in Provence and Languedoc in the end of the 12th century and beginning of the 13th century. It's taken over to Spain in the middle of the 13th century. It's widely response of criticism because people misunderstand what they try to do. They think that those are prayers for separated powers. Of course it's not prayers for separated powers. It prayer for the deity as perceived extends fears and endlessness. We know from the book Bahir that the deity is divided to infinite God and ten spheres. We know that it was considered to be a consecrated literature. We know from Sefer Yetzirah the idea of the ten spheres. Of course they are all united. We are told that they are like Shalevet Tzurah B'Chelem. The different dimensions of the divine processes are all but one unity. This one unity has different expressions and different dimensions and different attributes. They are praying to those different dimensions, which are part of the divine unity. Like the letters of the divine name, of course, are part of the divine name. You don't say that every letter is a divine unity. Of course, but you understand that if the ineffable name has four letters, of course the four letters constitute the divine name. But if each one of the letters is referring to a particular part of the ten spheres and you concentrate on the sphere on Yud and the sphere on Hay and the sphere on Vav, you are praying in order to put together the divine name, to put together the desolated temple, to put together the Shekhinah and the Shekhinah and Kudsh HaBrichu, or Tiferet and Malchut. It has numerous names, but the principle is very principle. You should unite the separate. You should rectify the shattered. You should put together the desolated. You should save the captive. The tragedy is projected on heaven. The action is projected on earth. It's people who pray, who study, who devote themselves, are those who are refugees. Now, in order to understand the next thing, we have a great teacher called Nachmanides. Nachmanides, Ramban, is a great halakhic authority, is a great leading public responsible, committed person. He's involved in the dialogue with the Christians. The Christians try to convince the Jews that the very fact that they're so successful in the Crusades, it's the very proof that they are never to wait for their redemption. They say, we sit in Jerusalem, we are the house of David, you would never be returned there. See how great we are, how successful we are. The church is saying it's loving it all the time. They are leading all kinds of public debates. The Kuach Tortosa, or the polemics and debate in Tortosa in Spain, was a very famous debate. As a result of this, Nachmanides had to run away and to go to the land of Israel, because he refused to consent to the Christian accusations that the success of the Crusaders is an absolute proof of the failure of Judaism and the failure of Jewish hope and the failure of redemption. He refused to take it, but then he imposed it on him, he had to run away. But before he ran away, he developed a whole school of mystics, which exactly continues with what I explained now. The more we pray with those mystical orientations, the greater is the chance to see the change. So in a way, let's say, he says, disregard the historical circumstances. Disregard the success of Christianity. One cannot ignore it, but disregard it. Concentrate on the heaven, concentrate on the spiritual dialogue, concentrate on the mystical insight, with hints, with symbols. We don't want to be too blunt about it. We have the whole Christian world on our neck watching what we say. So we are talking on Amalek, we are talking on Samael, we are talking on Tidrasa, but you never say who is the addressee of those names, but it's rather obvious. However, while he was kicking it, Nachmanides, again, very Christian, with a great deal of authority, with directions who would do what and who will say. At the very same time, a young group of scholars stepped forward and said, we don't want to keep it secret anymore, we want to do entirely different. Now, the idea, they're the same ideas, the symbols are the same symbols, only what's now the esoteric, exoteric scheme is different. Those people who knew directly or indirectly what's going on in the highly authoritative school of Nachmanides stepped forward and said, we don't wish to work under that authority. We wish to claim the following claim. The Messianic era is starting now. Okay? Don't say that exile is now. Say that the messianic era is starting now. How do you know that, you may ask? Here is your proof. A book that was kept secretly for thousands of years is revealed right now. Who wrote this book? What's the question? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the great sage of the second century. Thousands of years later, let's say that he was around 230, end of the second, beginning of the third, in the 13th century, about 1,000 years later, after the Tana Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, a group of people wrote a book ascribed to him, believing profoundly that they represent the world as he would have envisioned. This group of people say, our proof that the Messianic era starts is the fact that the hidden book is revealed. But next sentence is the important one. Only when you would study our secret book, then revelation would come. Then salvation would come. Okay, it's like a lula'ah, like a double loop. They say the following. We want to take this mystical work one step further. We want to take it out from the secret circle and to take it out to the street. We want to teach it on the public. We are going to be outward with it. We're not going to be secretive about it. We're going to be outward. We're going to take all the literature that was written around in the Catalonia places, in the literature of the students of the Provence places. We start in Provence, we go to Catalonia, and now a new circle is forming in Castilla. Castilla is where the Zohar is being written. Zohar, which means the book of splendor, which means the book of creativity, which means the book of the divine new revelation is being written. They take again the old materials, they take the old building blocks, and they say, we know that now we are going to see, we're going to demonstrate to you how the world is going to be stepping into the era of redemption, not only in the era of exile. How do you know? Because the book has been revealed. What should we do in order to bring redemption forward? We should study Zohar very seriously. We should learn the Zohar very profoundly. Now what is the Zohar about? The Zohar is inventing the past in order to invent the future. Again, the Zohar is inventing the past, reinventing the past, in order to reinvent the future. What does the Zohar disregard? The present. The best way to deal with the present is disregard it, especially if your present is very painful and very unchangeable and very passive imposing. What do? They take the two poles of time zone. They take the past, which they can reinvent, and they take the future, which they can reinvent. And so they say, we will tell you much about the past, and we will show you the way to the future. Now their past is an inventive past. It's not a real past. It's an inventive past. But it's beautifully inventive past. It's a creative inventive past. In their literature, they say, there was a bunch of students who were going around, who were not part of an establishment. The whole entire book of Zohar, which is 20,000 pages, never have a yeshiva, they never have a study house, they never have a scholarly room. They are always out, they are on the field, they are rather anarchic in this sense. They are not centered in one place, but they are walking around, they are midrashim basadeh, they are traveling on the field. They are not concentrating in one place, they are on the road. They are playful, they are not tragic. Instead of putting the focus on the tragedy of death, we started Kabbalah with tragedy. We started Kabbalah with tragedy in heaven, with tragedy in heaven. The next stage, the 30 end of the 13th century circle that formed the Zohar, it turned to be rather playful. They say the way to redeem ourselves is by imaginary playfulness of reading the ancient text and deciphering the mystical meaning of it, but not as a started in very authoritative circles with full awareness of the strategy, projecting strategy on medicine. In the end of the century, in the 13th century, we have a group of people who say, we don't care for esotericism. We don't care for restrictive discipline measures of who will teach what and to whom. We want to revert it the other way around. We take, first of all, pseudo-epigraphy. Pseudo-epigraphy is, we will not tell you who we are. Okay? Pseudo-epigraphy gives us complete freedom. We would say what we believe is important, but we are not going to tell you who are we. In the first stage, we are very much told who are we. As I said time and again, the names of the Rivet and Bala Sagot and the Pakpadinao and Rabbi Ezra and Rabbi Azir, they are all historical people. We know their names and their lifetime and what they've been doing. We know plenty on them. Any book of the history of Jews in Provence and history of Jews in Catalonia will give you full data on all of them. No one can give you full data directly on who wrote the Zohar. We know that these people who were there in Spain, they were engaging in mystical studies, only they did a complete reversal. Therefore, we will not talk on the name of authority. We would not say we are Rabbi Abraham ben David Bala Sagot. We are not Rabbi Sabina Ho, the well-known mystical authority. We would not tell you who we are, but we would write such a book that would change history. And in fact, they succeeded in their idea. But in order to be so successful, they had to reinvent such a history that would make it a way to the future. But they start the bridge between the past and the future by the very idea that redemption had started already. So now we are not in the complete desolation, but we are on an avenue which says, we see the light in the end of the tunnel. We see the light in the end of the tunnel. In order to enlarge the light, we are going to be involved in understanding the mystical meaning of the whole entire Jewish literature. We are going to retell the Mishnah, we are going to retell the Midrashim. We are going to do it in such a way that the playful, creative reading would enlarge the sponge thinking. They succeeded a great deal. First of all, they convinced the readers that it was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his fellows who were writing the Zohar. Why Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai? Why, any particular reason? Yeah, because he was... What? Maybe because he was a student of Rabbi Akiva, maybe because he lived in the cave for 13 years and had a Gilui Aliyah. He was definitely an eccentric figure, also in the Mishnah. When he's stepping out of the cave, he says, I would like to burn the whole world because nobody is as deserving as I am, or the generation does not deserve it. It's really quite a character. However, the point of importance is that thousands of pages of entirely new way of perception are ascribed to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his students. Now he is typified entirely new as a messianic figure, but as a messianic figure, as a central figure who can redeem the world by its very existence. Now they make him to be a present perfect sort of a figure, although it is supposed to depict the Mishnah time, he is like transcending borders kind of a figure, and his history is depicted in the book of the Zohar. Not only him and his son and his students and fellow sages, they are rewriting the Mishnah, actually. They are rewriting the Mishnah without particular interest in the legal material, but with great interest with the Midrashic material. And they are reading the Holy Text with new inspiration. They want to show that the way from exile to redemption is through spiritual creativity. They succeeded in convincing the whole board of Jewish